From New York, this is Democracy Now!
You were told that Mr. Floyd died because his heart was too big. You heard that testimony. And the truth of the matter is that the reason George Floyd is dead is because Mr. Chauvin's heart was too small.
Minneapolis is on edge as jury deliberations begin in the trial of former officer Derek Chauvin for murdering George Floyd by kneeling on his neck for 9 minutes and 29 seconds. 3,000 members of the National Guard have been deployed as Minneapolis braces for protests. We'll go there for the latest. Then the Sikh community is in mourning after a gunman attacked a FedEx facility in Indianapolis, killing 8 people, half of them Sikh.
Mass shooting in Indianapolis this past week was a tragedy. It was a tragedy for all the families who were affected. It was a tragedy for the local Sikh community, which feels targeted. It's a tragedy for all Americans as we grapple as a country with the epidemic of gun violence and hate and white supremacy.
The Indianapolis shooting is one of at least 150 mass shootings so far this year in the United States. Will lawmakers finally take action? All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Jury deliberations have become in the trial of Derek Chauvin, the former Minneapolis police officer charged with murder and manslaughter for killing George Floyd by kneeling on his neck for over 9 minutes last May. On Monday, jurors heard closing arguments in one of the most closely watched criminal trials in years. This is prosecutor Steve Schleicher.
You can believe your eyes. It's exactly what you believed. It's exactly what you saw with your eyes. It's exactly what you knew. It's what you felt in your gut. It's what you now know in your heart. This wasn't policing. This was murder.
Judge Peter Cahill gave final instructions to 12 jurors who will remain sequestered at a hotel during their deliberations. Thousands of students from dozens of Minnesota schools walked out of classes Monday, demanding justice for George Floyd and for Dante Wright, the 20-year-old black man shot dead by a white police officer during a traffic stop in the Minneapolis suburb of Brooklyn Center April 11th. The city's mayor, Mike Elliott, a black man who's born in Liberia, told CNN Monday it's not safe to drive in Minnesota while you're black.
And if we see police behind us, we're afraid, you know, we're trembling. And that is a kind of terror that no citizen of the United States should ever have to face. It's constant. It's ever present.
Ahead of the verdict, Minnesota Governor Tim Walz called up 3,000 members of the National Guard, along with 1,100 police officers from around Minnesota. Civil rights leader Jesse Jackson joined protests outside the courthouse Monday.
Even if we win. Victory. They're still killing our people.
They're still killing our people.
Stop the violence.
Stop the violence.
Save the children.
Save the children.
Stop the violence.
Stop the violence.
Save the children.
Save the children.
After headlines, we'll go to Minneapolis for the latest on the Derek Chauvin trial. The World Meteorological Organization warned Monday of a relentless worsening of the climate crisis in 2020 as average temperatures soared to 1.2 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels. That's close to the 1.5 degree upper limit advocated by scientists to stave off the worst impacts of climate change. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres announced the findings of the annual State of the Global Climate Report.
We are seeing, indeed, that we live in a triple crisis, a climate crisis, a biodiversity crisis, and a pollution crisis. And if we don't act immediately, we are, as I said, on the verge of the abyss. There is no time to lose.
The WMO says record heat has accumulated in the world's oceans, which are becoming more acidic and less oxygenated. 2020 saw sea level rise from melting glaciers in Greenland and Antarctica, near record low sea ice in the Arctic, severe flooding in Asia and Africa, extreme drought in South America, and a record 30 named storms during the Atlantic hurricane season. Meanwhile, over 400 climate experts have warned governments are criminalizing and silencing peaceful environments environmental protesters, including Extinction Rebellion, the Sunrise Movement, and School Strike for Climate. Their open letter reads, quote, "It's become abundantly clear that governments don't act on climate without pressure from civil society. Threatening and silencing activists thus seems to be a new form of anti-democratic refusal to act on climate," they said. The United States and China said Sunday the two nations will work together with other countries on tackling the climate crisis. The commitment by the world's two largest greenhouse gas emitters came ahead of a virtual climate summit this week hosted by President Joe Biden. India's capital has been ordered to lock down for 6 days as coronavirus cases surge to record levels. Just before the lockdown took effect, thousands of migrant workers rushed to bus terminals in Delhi's outskirts, bound for hometowns away from the capital. Public health officials warn the mass exodus could lead to new COVID outbreaks. India reported nearly 260,000 new infections Monday, but a shortage of testing capacity means the true level of infection is likely far higher. Several major Indian cities have reported far higher numbers of cremations and burials than official death counts. About 8% of people in India have received at least one dose of a COVID vaccine. On Friday, the head of the Serum Institute of India, the world's single largest producer of vaccines, urged President Biden to lift a U.S. export ban on raw materials critical to the production of vaccines. Globally, COVID-19 cases have surpassed January's peak to set a new record high amidst a growing disparity in vaccination rates between rich countries and the global south. On Monday, youth climate activist Greta Thunberg said her foundation would donate $120,000 to the UN's COVAX initiative to purchase vaccines for poorer nations.
It is completely unethical that high-income countries are now vaccinating young and healthy people if that happens at the expense of people in risk groups and on the front lines in low- and middle-income countries. And this is a moral test. We talk today about showing solidarity, and yet vaccine nationalism, it's what's running the vaccine distribution.
President Biden Monday urged all U.S. residents 16 and older to get vaccinated against COVID-19 as his administration began its campaign to combat vaccine hesitancy.
Everybody is eligible as of today to get the vaccine. You have enough of it, you need to be protected, and you need in turn to protect your neighbors and your family. So please. Get the vaccine.
U.S. coronavirus infections remain on a high plateau with another 68,000 new cases and nearly 500 deaths reported Monday. The Cuban Communist Party has chosen President Miguel Díaz-Canel as its new leader, replacing Raúl Castro, who announced his retirement last week. This marks the first time the party's led by a person outside the Castro family since Fidel Castro led the Cuban Revolution in 1959. The party's change in leadership comes amidst an economic crisis in Cuba, exacerbated by harsh U.S. sanctions. Elsewhere in the Caribbean, a thick layer of volcanic ash has settled over the island of St. Vincent after a long, dormant volcano erupted earlier this month. More than 20,000 people have been evacuated and are in urgent need of food, water, clothing and shelter. On Monday, Prime Minister Ralph Gonsalves appealed to the UN Security Council for help.
Please help St. Vincent and the Grenadines in its midnight hour of need. Nearly one-fifth of the island's population has had to be evacuated to safer areas. A monumental challenge of humanitarian relief.
In South Africa, a devastating wildfire has spread to the University of Cape Town, destroying irreplaceable historical records and documents that were being stored in the university's library. The blaze, which began raging since Sunday, tore through a portion of the 200-year-old campus, forcing staff and students to evacuate. South African officials say the wildfire was likely started by an individual, then quickly spread due to heavy winds and high temperatures. The Washington, D.C. chief medical examiner has ruled that Capitol Police officer Brian Sicknick suffered two strokes and died of natural causes. The 42-year-old officer died January 7th, the day after the Capitol insurrection. In March, federal agents arrested two men for attacking Sicknick with a chemical spray January 6th. The ruling is expected to dampen efforts to pursue homicide charges in his death. Meanwhile, a federal judge has ordered two leaders of the far-right Proud Boys to remain in jail while they await trial for their involvement in the January 6th insurrection. The ruling reversed an earlier decision to release Ethan Nordine and Joseph Biggs from pretrial detention. Nordine is from Washington State, Biggs from Florida. Georgia Republican Congressmember Marjorie Taylor Greene has scrapped plans to form an America First caucus following pushback from leaders in her own party. A flyer promoting the caucus obtained by Punchbowl News features racist anti-immigrant language while promoting, quote, common respect for uniquely Anglo-Saxon political traditions, unquote. Congressmember Greene was elected in 2020. She's promoted the racist QAnon conspiracy theory, made frequent anti-Muslim and anti-Semitic comments, and voiced support for political violence against top Democrats, including House Speaker Nancy Pelosi. In Alabama, the labor union that failed in its month-long battle to organize an Amazon warehouse in the city of Bessemer has filed 23 complaints against the online retailer with the National Labor Relations Board. The retail, wholesale, and department store union says Amazon unlawfully interfered with union efforts by threatening to cut workers' pay, benefits, and time off work, while creating an impression of surveillance by installing private mailboxes at the warehouse so it could monitor workers' votes. This is Amazon worker Jennifer Bates.
There was illegal things taking place and fear tactics that was done to people who didn't have any idea about what a union could do for them.
Yeah.
Young people who thought that they were going to lose their job because the company said we're going to shut down.
Former Vice President Walter Mondale has died at the age of 93. He spent 12 years representing Minnesota in the U.S. Senate before becoming vice president under Jimmy Carter. In 1984, Mondale won the Democratic Party's nomination for the presidency and made history by picking a woman, Geraldine Ferraro, as his running mate. Mondale lost to incumbent Republican Ronald Reagan in a landslide. And in breaking news, the government of Chad is reporting President Idriss Deby has died of injuries he sustained while visiting government soldiers on the front lines of their battle against rebels in the north of Chad. Deby took power more than three decades ago after leading a 1990 rebellion that toppled the former U.S.-backed dictator Hissène Habré. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the Quarantine Report. When we come back, Minneapolis on the verge of, on the edge, as jury deliberations begin in the trial of former officer Derek Chauvin for murdering George Floyd. We'll be back in a minute. Our side has to win for DH by Godspeed, you Black Emperor. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now! Co-host Juan Gonzalez in New Brunswick, New Jersey. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
Well, jury deliberations have begun in the trial of Derek Chauvin, the former white Minneapolis police officer charged with murder and manslaughter for killing George Floyd by kneeling on his neck for 9.5 minutes last May. Floyd's death sparked international protests calling for racial justice. Authorities in Minnesota are now bracing for a verdict in one of the most closely watched criminal trials in years. During closing arguments, state prosecutor Steve Schleicher repeatedly reminded jurors this case was solely about Chauvin's actions, not about policing as a whole.
This use of force was unreasonable. It was excessive. It was grossly disproportionate. It is not an excuse for the shocking abuse that you saw with your own eyes. And you can believe your own eyes. This case is exactly what you thought when you saw it first, when you saw that video. It is exactly that. You can believe your eyes. It's exactly what you believed. It's exactly what you saw with your eyes. It's exactly what you knew. It's what you felt in your gut. It's what you now know in your heart. This wasn't policing. This was murder. The defendant is guilty of all three counts. All of them. And there's no excuse.
Derek Chauvin's defense lawyer, Eric Nelson, faulted prosecutors for focusing on the 9 minutes and 29 seconds when his client had his knee on George Floyd's neck.
So we get into the 9 minutes and 29 seconds at this point. And the state has really focused on the 9 minutes and 29 seconds. 9 minutes, 29 seconds. 9 minutes, 29 seconds. It's not the proper analysis. Because the 9 minutes and 29 seconds ignores the previous 16 minutes and 59 seconds. It completely disregards it. It says, in that moment, at that point, nothing else that happened before should be taken into consideration by a reasonable police officer. It tries to reframe the issue of what a reasonable police officer would do. A reasonable police officer would, in fact, take into consideration the previous 16 minutes and 59 seconds. Their experience with the subject, the struggle that they had, the comparison of the words to actions, it all comes into play. Why? Because human behavior is unpredictable. Human behavior is unpredictable, and nobody knows it better than a police officer.
The closing arguments ended with a rebuttal from state prosecutor Jerry Blackwell.
When Mr. Floyd is saying, please, please, I can't breathe, 27 times in just a few minutes, you saw it when Mr. Chauvin did not let up and we didn't get up. Even when he passed out, not breathing anymore, he doesn't let up or get up. When he knows he doesn't have a pulse, he doesn't let up or get up. Even when the ambulance comes, he doesn't let up or get up even then. They have to come up and tap him before he will let up and get up off the body of Mr. George Floyd. And they try to resuscitate him in the ambulance, and they never do. He never regains consciousness. He never breathes again. His heart never pumps again. And Mr. George Floyd was deceased. You were told, for example, that Mr. Floyd died, because his heart was too big. You heard that testimony. And now, having seen all the evidence, having heard all the evidence, you know the truth. And the truth of the matter is that the reason George Floyd is dead is because Mr. Chauvin's heart was too small.
After the conclusion of closing arguments, defense lawyer Eric Nelson filed a motion for a mistrial, claiming that recent comments by Democratic Congresswoman Maxine Waters could be construed as a threat against the jury. During a recent protest in Brooklyn Center, Minnesota, over the police killing of Dante Wright, the 20-year-old black man, Congressmember Waters said protesters should get more, quote, confrontational if Chauvin's not found guilty. Judge Peter Cahill refused to grant a mistrial, but said the comment could lead to the verdict being overturned on appeal. To talk more about the Derek Chauvin trial, we're joined by two guests. In St. Paul, Minnesota, John Thompson is with us, newly elected member of the Minnesota House of Representatives, longtime community activist. In 2016, police killed his friend Philando Castile during a traffic stop in a suburb of St. Paul. And Nikema Levy-Armstrong is back with us, the Minneapolis-based civil rights attorney, activist, and executive director of the Wayfinder Foundation. Levy-Armstrong previously served as president of the Minneapolis NAACP and is a law professor at the University of St. Thomas. We welcome you, Nikema, back to Democracy Now! Let's begin with you. Assess the closing arguments. What did you think of the prosecution and then of the defense?
I thought the prosecution in this case started strong and ended strong. They did an excellent job reminding the jury of all of the information that had come forward before, including the expert testimony. And they reminded the jury that they could believe what they had seen with their own eyes, not the shenanigans that Eric Nelson tried to put forward with a variety of different theories as to why George Floyd wound up dead on May 25th of 2020.
And Nikema Levy-Armstrong, what do you make of the defense's last-minute attempt, motion for a mistrial based on the comments of a Congresswoman Maxine Waters?
I thought, like many aspects of his side of the case and the theories he presented, it did not pass the laugh test. To think that an 82-year-old Congresswoman could be responsible for a mistrial really is absurd. Congresswoman Maxine Waters was well within her rights to show up in Brooklyn Center over the weekend and to stand in solidarity with those who are on the front lines demanding justice for Dante Wright as well as for George Floyd. And part of the reason for Congresswoman Waters' comments had to do with something known as Operation Safety Net, which is, from my perspective, a reign of terror that has been implemented by the Department of Public Safety in Minnesota and several other police departments in response to the uprisings that happened last summer after George Floyd was killed. We've experienced tear gas, rubber bullets, flashbang grenades, arrests and violence at the hands of law enforcement in Brooklyn Center.
I wanted to ask you about the another protest that happened this weekend that you participated in at the home of the Washington County Attorney, Pete Orpat, who filed second-degree manslaughter charges against the former Brooklyn Center police officer Kim Potter for the fatal shooting of Dante Wright. Can you talk about what happened there and what Orpat said to you?
Yes. So we organized a protest to go to Stillwater, Minnesota, which is about 40 minutes or so outside of the Twin Cities, to the home of Pete Orpat, who is responsible for filing charges in the case of Kim Potter, in which she killed Dante Wright. We determined that those charges are not strong enough, primarily because of what we've seen happen in a previous case, the case of Muhammad Noor, a Black Muslim Somali former officer who was charged with third-degree murder and convicted for killing Justine Rusicek Damon, a white woman, in 2017. His conviction marked the first time in Minnesota history that an officer had actually been convicted for killing a civilian. Somehow, the government was able to make the crime fit the statute, much to our surprise. And Muhammad Noor filed an appeal in that case, and the Court of Appeals has so far upheld his third-degree murder conviction. And so the facts of this case involving Kim Potter are similar to the facts involving Muhammad Noor. And we do not think that manslaughter charges are enough. We're demanding murder charges in this case for the life of Dante Wright, which was unnecessarily taken. So as we held this protest in front of Pete Orpat's home, we had actually marched down the street, and his neighbors were standing in solidarity with us, throwing up their fists in solidarity, and even chanting Black Lives Matter. Pete Orpitt thought that that we had left, but we were, again, just marching down the street. And he came outside his home with his wife and started apologizing to his neighbors for our demonstration. Well, Jelani Hussein, who's been on your show before, executive director of CARE Minnesota, was standing there. And he called Pete Orpitt over and said, why don't you apologize to me? Why don't you apologize to us for this, the undercharging that you've done in this case? So they began a dialogue, and then I walked up and got involved in the dialogue. And I let Pete Orpitt know that those charges were unacceptable. We were demanding murder charges, and that we would return back to his home in Stillwater until we see murder charges in this case. We cannot allow prosecutors to undercharge or not charge at all police officers who needlessly take the lives of civilians, as what we have seen in this case.
I wanted to bring Minnesota State Representative John Thompson into this conversation. You've been out in the streets. You're in the legislature now. You are a close friend of Philando Castile, who was gunned down by police in 2016. Can you talk about this trajectory, if you can call it that, and what you want to see right now and what you're doing in the legislature around the issue of police accountability?
We have to put accountability pieces into legislation here in the state of Minnesota. Our legislative body has made it so that the law protects the actions of these officers. And sometimes these actions are erroneous actions. Give me a second. Can you hear me?
Yep, everything is perfect. We can see you and hear you fine.
Yeah, some of these actions are heinous acts of violence against young Black men here in this state. A traffic stop, your headlight is out, your blinker's not working, you have an air freshener in your window. You know, these are pretextual stops to gain access to the car. But ultimately, what's really happening is these officers are seeing who's in the car and saying, that's a Black man driving that car, racially profiling these Black men. And some of these traffic stops turn deadly, and these cars are turning into caskets for some of these young African-American men. Case in point with Philando Castile and Dante. You know, these are traffic stops. I mean, you should get a ticket and go home. But that's not the case. Even with George Floyd, you know, the funny thing is when Philando died in 2016, when he was murdered in St. Anthony, in Falcon Heights, the buzzwords here in this state were implicit bias training and de-escalation training. That was 2016. But I find it really strange that the field training officer killed George Floyd and the field training officer killed Dante. What are you training these officers is what I'm asking.
I mean, this is a critical point you're making, that the person who is in charge of training the others at the site, Kim Potter, when it came to what happened with Wright, and Derek Chauvin, who is the senior there, who was supposedly training the others. What do you make of this? Because, well, the prosecution, perhaps for other reasons, was making the point that policing is not on trial. Derek Chauvin is.
You know, I wanted to talk about something you asked Sister Nakima Levy-Pound when you asked her about Maxine Waters and her statements here. You know, me and Nakima Levy-Pound showed up to an officer's home this past summer. This officer has 56 complaints against him over his tenure, 11 successful lawsuits over his tenure, and was involved in 3 police-involved shootings. They voted this man as the president of the Minneapolis Police Federation, and he was promoted to sergeant. So what does that tell you about policing here in this state? We reward bad cops. This and by the way, this guy was also a member of the City Heat, which is a known white supremacist biker gang. But when we show up to his house, the same thing that happened to Maxine Waters happened to me on the campaign trail. I was called a domestic terrorist, Antifa, and he called us mad and angry. We have every right to be angry. We have every right to be mad, and we have every right to use our voices because their actions are what we're protesting against, right? This, we have a problem here in this state with policing.
Representative Thompson, I wanted to ask you, one of the things that you've been trying to do in the Minnesota House, a committee of the House recently approved your bill that would end qualified immunity for police officers. Why is this this particular reform so important to you, and what are the prospects you think of getting it through the whole House and then the tougher job of getting it through the Senate?
As a surgeon, as a doctor, you can't mistakenly put morphine in somebody's IV and say, oops, I made a mistake. They're going to walk you out of there in handcuffs. Should be no different for police officers in this state. Legislation in this state has made it possible for bad officers to get away with committing some of these crimes that they're committing in our state. Right. So for me, I propose legislation that would actually put some meat on the word reform here. But the problem is our Senate is not hearing any of it. They don't want to hear anything about police reform because either their friends are police officers or they're ex-police officers themselves, and they're catering to these police unions. For the Senate here, they seem to think that the police unions, the Chiefs Association, they get to tell us what reform looks like. And if they don't agree with any provisions we put forth, it won't move through this body.
And so, what about the relationship between the police union and the legislature? Could you talk more about what you've seen firsthand now that you're in the legislature?
I've seen firsthand the PPP. Police unions punking politicians firsthand. I've seen it firsthand. Case in point, with me, for instance, I show up to this man's house and I'm being heckled by these patriots. And one of them spit at me. And so I go on this, like, I'm angry and I yell at him and I tell him, if you don't support black people, then, you know, you can Google this stuff. It's me. But I was attacked throughout the entire campaign trail by police union, the Chiefs Federation, and police officers all across this state. And what they did to the Democrats in this state and said, if you if you got a donation from the police unions, they were taking the donations that they'd given you and giving it to the Republican who was running against you in their race. And so that's what we see here with policing in this state, is they play a major role in our elections also. And they make big donations to some of our Republican colleagues, who in turn give them exactly what they want when it comes to not voting for reform. Listen, these people got George Floyd killed, they got Philando killed, and they ultimately failed Dante Wright and several others.
Look at the timing. Back July 5th, 2016, Alton Sterling was killed by police in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. You talked to Philando about this as that news came out, and the next day he was killed by police in a suburb of St. Paul. Can you talk about how your then activism on the street has what it's meant for you to be in the state assembly right now? But I mean, that is just astounding, from Alton Sterling to Philando and what you're doing with Philando's mother right now.
If you were to follow me in 2016, I promised the legislative body that we would put people in place to replace them. I also told them that I would be replacing some of the legislators who've been here 22 years uncontested, because a lot of the disparities we see in this state happen on their watch. Legislation created everything that we see as far as disparities in this state, and legislation can fix them. I know what I wanted to see out of my legislator, and so I just became one. Valerie Castillo, I don't know if people know this, but right after Philando died, my son was shot 6 times at a funeral, and then I lost my mother. And Valerie Castillo has been filling that void as far as a mother's role since then. And so I promised her I'd stick by her side. We just proposed legislation in this state. It was Minnesota House File 784. which would actually take the need for so much public safety out of our communities if they were investing in things that they're not investing in, you know, like jobs and economic development, housing, STEM training, culturally competent tutors and mental health providers. And when I put this bill forth to the body, they told me that this was a racist bill because I'm asking for money for the African-American community. You know, this is what I'm up against dealing with our legislation. But here's the thing, is I actually put my name on the ballot, hopefully to inspire other young black men like myself to put their name on the ballot. We don't need another rapper in our community. We need people to be legislators, lawyers, doctors, teachers, and everything that we have. A void, every void that we have, we need filled by young black men and women in our state. And so I have to show them, if they see it, they can be it. And so that's what I'm doing. I'm inspiring others to be the change they want to see in the community.
Senator, I wanted to ask you, back in 2017, the officer who killed your friend Philando Castile was acquitted on charges of manslaughter. What are you watching for in the outcome of the Chauvin trial? And are you hopeful that this time around the justice will be served?
Hey, excuse my French, but I've been a black man all my life. I watched Emmett Till. I watched Rodney King. I watched Philando Castile. All of their killers walked right out of court and was found ultimately not guilty of the crime that we all know they should have been found guilty of. So there's nothing different here in this state. We are preparing for the worst and hoping for the best. And that's the best I can do as far as this right here. I'm not gonna beat myself up. I'm preparing for a not guilty verdict, to be honest with you.
And what will you do then?
I'll go even harder. I'll go even harder to create the change that we need to see in our community. Listen, there's going to be another police-involved killing in this state this year, simply because we refuse to hear anything about police reform. You got to think about half of these people walked into George Floyd's funeral with VIP tickets, and they had these credentials. I'm talking about people in our legislative body. And then they walked right back into the state capitol, and they gave us nothing on police reform. You know, and that was on Juneteenth. Here we are this day and age right now in 2021, in April of 2021, they're still not giving us anything on police reform. They won't even give us hearing. Right now, they're asking for $20 million in our legislative body to bring extra police here to prepare for this verdict. But we can't even get $2 million for culturally intelligent tutors in our community.
Well, I want to thank you so much, Minnesota State Representative John Thompson, part of the People of Color Indigenous Caucus that's called on fellow lawmakers in St. Paul to halt budget negotiations until police accountability laws are passed, saying reform cannot wait. And Nikema Levy-Armstrong, civil rights attorney, activist, and executive director of the Wayfinder Foundation. Next up, the sick community is in mourning after a gunman attacked a FedEx facility. 90% of the people who work there are sick. This is the Indianapolis killing of 8 people. Half of those killed were sick. Stay with us. Thank you. Untitled Number 2 by John Frusciante. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. More details are coming out about last week's mass shooting at an Indianapolis FedEx facility, where the 8 victims have been identified. They're Matthew Alexander, Samaria Blackwell, Amarjeet Johal, Jasvinder Singh, Amarjeet Sekhon, Jasvinder Kaur, Carly Smith, and John Weissert. 4 of the victims are members of a local Sikh community. Indianapolis police say Brandon Hole, the 19-year-old white mass murderer and former FedEx employee who then killed himself, legally purchased the 2 semi-automatic rifles used in Thursday's attack just a few months after police seized a shotgun from him after his mother raised concerns about his mental state. But prosecutors said Monday they did not try to use Indiana's red flag law, which could have prevented Hole from obtaining the 2 guns. We'll have more on that later in the show. Authorities have not shared evidence Hole was targeting Sikh workers when he attacked the FedEx facility. But on Monday, police revealed they'd previously found evidence that Hole had browsed white supremacist websites. Most of the workers in the FedEx warehouse next to the airport in Indianapolis, Hole attacked, were Sikh. This is Indianapolis Sikh community member Rimpi Gurn, who knew 2 of the victims, speaking to NBC.
We were going to have a party at this time, and now we're arranging a funeral. It's hard. It's sad. All they wanted to do was just provide a good life to their family.
Tragically, the Indianapolis mass shooting took place as more than 15 states across the country, including Indiana, are marking April as Sikh Awareness and Appreciation Month. For more, we're joined by Simranjit Singh, scholar, activist, senior fellow for the Sikh Coalition, which is calling for a full investigation into the possibility of racial or ethnic hatred as a factor in the killings in Indianapolis. His recent piece for CNN is headlined, "Why Sikh Americans Again Feel Targeted After the Indianapolis Shooting." Welcome back to Democracy Now! I'm so sorry to have you back under these circumstances, Simran, but talk about what you're calling for.
Sure. I mean, I will start by saying, you know, these families, as we heard in that clip, these families are devastated. And, you know, there were Sikh families that were harmed and hurt in this attack. There were families who don't identify as Sikh who were hurt in this attack. And it's so painful to hear their stories and to humanize them, to really recognize what they're going through. And I'd also say that this community in Indianapolis, across the country, all around the world, is also devastated. And I think that's in part because we know that attacks like these, they're meant for all of us, that any of us could be affected. And then we have to ask ourselves, when is it coming for our parents? When will we be attacked? Will our kids be safe? And I think that's a lot of the sentiment in the community right now. And so, given the pattern of violence against Sikhs, we are demanding a full investigation into the possibility of bias and racism in this attack. And we don't know what the authorities will conclude, but we know that the feeling among the community is that once again, year after year, week after week, we are undergoing real white supremacist violence in this country. And that's not something we're willing to stand down on.
Simran, could you talk a little bit about this, the history of these of this kind of violence targeting the Sikh community, even before 9/11, but since 9/11 as well?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, so many of these stories, as they come up, we minimize them and think about them as one-off incidents, and we say, well, this attack targets the Sikh community, and you know, that's too sad, and let's move on. But I think there's something much deeper here, right? So we can look back to the past few years and look at the massive spike in anti-Sikh hate crimes that have been reported by the FBI. From 2017 to 2018, we saw 200% increase in reported hate crimes against Sikhs. 200%. I mean, ask any statistician or sociologist, that's not a number that we see, right? That's not normal. we can talk about the 2012 massacre against Sikhs in Oak Creek, Wisconsin, in which a white supremacist entered their place of worship while they were praying and just slaughtered Sikh Americans. And so it's not just today, it's 10 years, right? That's 10 years. And this year, as we're marking 20 years since 9/11, we can look at the racist backlash that ensued after the terrorist attacks, in which Americans all over the country looked at people who looked like me with their turbans, beards, and brown skin and saw them as the enemy and started killing them too. And so much of our narrative is around these sorts of moments, but I think it's critical. I appreciate your question, Juan, because when we limit our understandings to the modern moment and we erase history or we forget about history, we ignore the reality that these are long-standing problems. Sikhs first came to this country 100 years ago, more than 100 years ago. And they started being subjected to racist violence immediately thereafter. The first race riots targeting Sikhs occurred in 1907 in Bellingham, Washington. And then the rhetoric was around Hindus, quote unquote, and around people who were stealing their jobs. And so, I mean, you know, we can look at this and tell ourselves that, oh, this is today's problem and that we should move forward. And, you know, we should, but we won't be able to move forward until we name the real problem here, which is the long history of xenophobia and white supremacy in America. If we look at these as historically connected issues, and if we can see how these are patterns that connect other communities and other kinds of racist violence, then we'll be able to recognize the reality of racist violence and white supremacy in this country, and then we'll be able to take that on correctly.
And so often in some of these cases, though, as for instance, the attacks on the nail salons in Atlanta recently, and now this, it's not immediately apparent whether these are directly white supremacist motivated. But have you been in touch with any of the community in Indianapolis or some of the victims to get a sense of what you're able to piece together about the killer in this instance?
You know, it's a really important question, because in a lot of these instances of hate violence, we don't actually know the motives of the attackers. You know, people don't typically come forward and announce, I'm killing you because you are XYZ identities. And so there are rare instances, actually, where we have real evidence. And that's part of the problem in how we think about and categorize racism in this country. We know that the evidence and the science and the research shows us over and over again that there is implicit bias lurking within each of us. And in a lot of these instances, it's impossible. It's literally impossible to separate out the biases that we hold and the actions that we take. And so in a situation like this, here's what we know. We know that there's a 19-year-old white man who had access to guns when he shouldn't have. He entered a place of work that where he used to be employed. He knew that the facility was heavily populated by Punjabi Sikh immigrants, many of whom look like me. And he killed them. He murdered them. This was premeditated. It was not a crime of convenience. It wasn't a random act. This was something that he premeditated. And so these are some of the points of reality that we cannot dismiss. And again, I would go back to what impact does it have on these communities, whether we're talking about the anti-Asian hate crimes happening all across the country, in which we see a pattern of targeted attacks by a killer in Atlanta, or in a situation like this. Again, we don't have to know what these people are announcing. We don't necessarily know the bias in their hearts and what motivated them, but we know in both cases, and in cases all over the country, that hate was in their hearts. Murder was on their minds. And that is a problem that we all have to be able to sort out.
And what we do also know is that when police, the Washington Post is reporting this today, went to his house a year ago after his mother said he's dangerous, he's probably going to commit suicide by cop, and they took his gun away, and we're going to talk more about this with a gun control advocate in a minute, that they saw on his computer that he was visiting white supremacist websites. Now, Simran, you have called in a letter with your coalition sent to the White House to appoint a sick American liaison to the White House Office of Public Engagement. Already, President Biden has appointed an Asian American liaison after the Atlanta murders. Talk about why specifically you want it to be a sick that you want in addition a sick American liaison, and why you want President Biden to go to sick communities to educate the public.
I appreciate that question. I'll answer both of them. Why is it important for President Biden to go to Indianapolis? We've called on him to do so. I hope he does. And part of the reason is, in this country, there are messages that are sent from the top down that really impact how we see one another. And we saw that during Donald Trump's presidency, and we're seeing it again now in President Biden's presidency. And so we know that leadership and gestures matter. And we're not asking him to come to Indianapolis because we need him to validate our pain or our existence. Like we know that we matter. We know that we have inherent human dignity just like everyone else. But we also believe that it's important for him to show that in a moment like this, that our communities are part of the American family. And if our leadership is going to other sites in situations like this to express their condolences and their grief, and they should, I think that's critically important, then we should be included in that too. And, you know, when the massacre in Oak Creek, Wisconsin happened, this was a pain point for the Sikh community that President Obama did not come. He did not have any sort of public moment with the community to show that we mattered. And rather, the message that was sent out was that we're part of the broader American family, as if we are distant cousins, as if we don't actually really belong here. And that messaging really matters for us. So that's one with regard to why we believe President Biden should come to Indianapolis and why it would matter, not just for us as sick Americans, but for the broader American public to see who we are and to see our humanity. And second, with regard to having a sick liaison in the White House, I think, you know, this is an important ask for people of all different identity groups, that we recognize in this increasingly diverse country that our challenges, while so many of them are shared, we have particularities about what our communities are going through. And so absolutely there should be a Sikh liaison in the White House, because otherwise, we've seen this over and over again throughout our history, we're ignored as a community. We have never had any sort of attention on us other than when hate crimes like this happen. I mean, even with regard to reporting, we're ignored until we're victims and the world wants to grieve with us and express their sympathies, and we appreciate that. But what about the rest of our lives? And where do we belong and how do we fit in? And so having a liaison in the White House, I think, would help address some of those concerns.
Simran, we want to thank you so much for being with us. Simranjit Singh, scholar, activist, senior fellow for the Sikh Coalition. We'll link to your piece headlined, Why Sikh Americans Again Feel Targeted After the Indianapolis Shooting. Now, we're going to continue on this shooting. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. As we look at how the mass shooting in Indianapolis is one of at least 150 mass shootings so far this year in the United States. Authorities in Indianapolis said Monday the mother of Brandon Hole, the 19-year-old mass murderer in Indianapolis, the former worker at that FedEx facility who shot and killed eight other people there, called police last year. The mother called police to say her son might commit suicide by cop, prompting them to seize his pump-action shotgun. But officials say they did not push for Hole to have a hearing under Indiana's red flag law, which allows police or courts to seize guns from people who show warning signs of violence. Marion County Prosecutor Ryan Mears said authorities chose not to seek the hearing because they lacked enough time under the law to gather evidence about his mental state and face the risk that Hole's gun last year would be returned to him. This comes as President Biden's ordered a series of executive actions on gun control, calling gun violence in the U.S. an epidemic and an international embarrassment. We go now to Nick Sapina, who is managing director for law and policy at Everytown for Gun Safety. Nick, thanks for joining us. Can you start off by explaining this red flag law in Indiana? How is it possible that this young man had a gun taken from him, but then he gets to buy two more long guns legally?
Yeah, well, Amy, you know, it is a question we're all asking ourselves after this tragedy. And, you know, a lot of the headlines coming out of this tragic incident are about the failure of the red flag laws, or the failure of red flag laws generally. And it really isn't. The red flag law never was used here. And as you said, you know, the prosecutor choosing not to go to court to take the next step in the process, which would be to file an application with the court to make a showing that this man is a danger to himself or others. And at that time, if the court makes that finding, not only would the police be able to take any weapons in his possession, but he would also be added to a prohibited purchaser list. And so the very thing that the law is designed to prevent, going and buying a new gun, was not even ever sought here. And he then went on to buy two semi-automatic assault rifles middle of last year and used them to such deadly effect in Indianapolis at the FedEx facility.
And Nick, what do we know about why the prosecutor chose not to move forward with an application?
You know, we don't know very much. The prosecutor has pointed to the concern that perhaps the application doesn't succeed. But that's a tough pill to swallow, especially in the face of a tragedy like this. You know, you have to use the laws or else they will not work. We are at Everytown advocating in 50 states and the federal government for laws that can protect our country, protect our citizens and our communities from gun violence, but they only work so well as the people who are you know, tasked with implementing them. And so to me, this is not a great excuse to point to deficiencies in the Indiana law, but rather a deficiency of action. And that's what we need right now in this country, is action on gun safety.
But Indiana does have, doesn't it, some of the weakest gun laws in the country? What's the age limit there for the purchase of guns? Because we're talking here about a 19-year-old, right?
Yeah, Ron, that's a great point. You know, there's been a lot of focus, renewed focus on the Indiana red flag law. But let's not forget, Indiana does have some of the weakest gun laws in the country. There is no prohibition on purchasing a firearm if you're under the age of 21. There is no prohibition on assault weapons or high-capacity magazines, as many other states have. And so, you know, the deficits in Indiana law are manifest here, and Indiana has trailed, the rest of the country in terms of its gun violence prevention laws. And as we see, you know, frequently the gun laws in Indiana are so weak that they have become a supply state for Illinois in cities like Chicago, where many of the guns recovered in crimes in Chicago started off in Indiana.
Nick, we only have 30 seconds, but we're talking about a moment now where the NRA, the National Rifle Association, is completely hobbled. You have the mass American population, including NRA members, overwhelmingly for more gun control. Overwhelmingly. The only people who are stopping the legislation are the Republican senators in the U.S. Congress, the Republican senators. How is this possible at this moment, and how do you see getting around this? 20 seconds.
Well, you know, the answer always for us in the gun violence prevention movement is fight, fight, fight. Join the fight. Text CHECKS to 64433. Join that fight. because there is overwhelming support for sensible, sensible gun policies. And the GOP senators have lost all of their excuses for not standing with us and passing common sense gun reform.
Nick Cipollino, we want to thank you for being with us, Managing Director for Law and Policy at Every Town for Gun Safety. And that does it for our show, Democracy Now! Produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzner, Nermin Sheikh, Maria Terracena, Carla Wills, Tammy Warren, Afterina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astugio, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Honey Masood, Adriana Contreras, our General Manager, Julie Crosby, Becca Staley, our Director. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Stay safe. Wear a mask.